The following interview with John Stutzman by William Burr took place in San Francisco, California on June 22, 1988. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Research Office and the Foundation for Romanian Studies.
Okay, fine.
Does this just work
right now? Uh-huh. That's right.
My name is John Hale Stutzman. I was born in Washington, D.C. in 1920. Educated in a variety of schools, and then Princeton, graduated Princeton in 1942 in a history major, and then went to war, served as a captain of field artillery in the war in Europe, fighting in Italy for a couple of years. And I took my Foreign Service written exam in Italy at the end of the war in Europe. And when the war ended in Japan, I came home and took and passed the oral examination in the spring of 46 and was commissioned Foreign Service officer in mid-year of 1946. I asked to be assigned to the Far East, which I had never seen, and was sent to be a vice consul in the U.S. Consul General in Shanghai. In 1949, I was chased out of China by the communists and returned home and asked for an assignment to the U.S. Embassy in Tehran because I had developed an interest in Central Asia. Now, one of the problems with America's perception of Iran, in my opinion, is the generalization that it is essentially like the Arab nations of the Near East. In fact, historically, it is on the warring frontier between the eastward-pushing Arabs and the southwesterly drive of the Aryan and Turco peoples. I thought then of Iran as essentially a Central Asian country, and I still think it can be described in those terms. I also wanted to get out of the consular work, which I'd been performing in the great port of Shanghai, and it is significant that Tehran is 1,000 miles from any port. I also married at that time, and so in mid-1949, I took a bride from San Francisco to Tehran. The U.S. Embassy was then functioning in the old German embassy on a main city street near the British and the Russian compounds. The ambassador, John C. Wiley, was a subtle, experienced, superb diplomat, but he never came to the embassy. His entire tour in Tehran, he never entered the offices of the embassy. He remained at his residence, where he established his personal office, his secretary and his senior staff would join him there every day, and I was present one time when he told a bemused security officer that his poodles would take care of any intruders. Now, the staff at the time of my arrival was very small. Ambassador Wiley, who is no longer alive, the DCM Arthur Richards, who is alive still in Washington, an adjutant named Joe Wagner, a gentle administrator, long dead, had been brought by Wiley from their last post together in Lisbon. The economic commercial officer was John Ordway, who is still alive in Seattle. The political officer was Jerry Dewar, long dead, a charming Irish type who loved the play of intrigue and joined with Ambassador Wiley in a variety of bewildering and generally unproductive games. The CIA chief of station was Roger Guaron, still alive in Florida, an experienced and deft professional. John Waller, who recently retired from one of CIA's most senior positions, Inspector General, was one of his assistants. I was the junior officer, and therefore, despite my longing for a change, I was put in charge of consular affairs. Another junior officer, C.H. Walter Howe, whose widow I have just married, arrived in Tehran at the same time we did, and was assigned to be consul at Tabriz. So began my involvement in Iranian affairs. In mid-1949, it would last 5 years, except for a brief break of a month's home leave. The first half of that time, I was at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, moving from the consular to the political section in 1950. I served three ambassadors there, John Wiley, Henry Grady, and Loy Henderson. The second half of those 5 years was spent in Washington, where I became the Iran desk officer. In those 5 years, I was a close witness to the rise and fall of Mohammad Mossadegh, the fiery nationalist leader. I was in Iran when he came to power and drove out the British. I was in Washington when he was overthrown and the young Shah established a power base and friendship for the West, which would last another 20 years. I became a joyful admirer of the Persian people. More than most people, they are affected by their place on earth. I do not mean that in environmental terms, as the jungle affects the Bantu or the desert affects the Bedouin. I mean their geographical location. They live on a bridge across which conquering hordes have moved since the beginning of martial man, yet they survive. And the present boundaries of Iran are astonishingly similar to those of Cyrus, who brought together the Medes and Persians and set the stage for expansion west and east. The language of Iran today bears close resemblance to that of the Indo-European ancestors who rode in from the steppes of Russia. The record of the extraordinary resistance of the Persian people to successive conquests compares to the Indo-European people who held the Anatolian plateau for a thousand years until the Turks came. Then everything changed there, language, race, religion. But in Iran, there remains a remarkable similarity to the ancient past. The Arabs conquered Iran. In consequence, the Arab courts became glorious centers of Persian influence, reaching with the Islamic conquests into Spain and ultimately to South America, where I was warmly aware when I was at an arid post in the Andes of Bolivia, that their Spanish colonial artifacts bore the clear impression and influence of Persian art. Now, another characteristic of the Persians which has always delighted me is that a Persian will never lie. He believes absolutely sincerely in everything he says. The wise foreign correspondent, Georgiane Geyer, was astonished that Khomeini would tell her things that he would contradict completely in an interview with another correspondent shortly after. This is as natural as breathing to a Persian. It's like dealing with a flowing stream. And I mention this because I think this is pertinent to any view of Mossadegh and his attitude toward negotiations with the West. One other characteristic, the Persian feels the unseen hand in every moment of his personal and national life. This is not superstition, it's a palpable fact. Mossadegh rose to power on a wave of anti-British feeling. Yet many, and perhaps even he, believed that he was a British tool. If it was happening, the unseen hand, then the British, was causing the event. In the last year of the Shah's reign and today, it is the American, the last years of the Shah's reign and today, it is the American who is that unseen hand. And I don't think it would be hard to find a Persian today who could explain Khomeini in terms of his being a tool of American policy. That's the sort of introduction that I had in mind. And now I'm open to any questions that you have.
Yeah, that raises more questions in my mind that we can discuss as we go along. You mentioned earlier John Wiley, the ambassador. What kind of relationship did he develop with Iranian officials, the Shah for that matter, as ambassador?
I think John Wiley's attitude toward the Shah was deeply marked by the difference in their age and their experience. I won't say that Wiley scorned him, but I think Wiley looked on him as simply a young and uninformed man. Indeed, that's the way he treated his junior officers. On the other hand, Wiley always dealt with him properly in terms of diplomatic deference. And there is a dispatch in the files of the department, which is a very famous one, in which Wiley cut out from a Life magazine article pictures of the French comedian, I can't think of his name right now, who bore a remarkable resemblance to Wiley. And Wiley illustrated a report on an interview with the Shah with these pictures. Fernandel was the comic's name. And it's a charming report to read, but it reflects the basic attitude of Wiley, which was that the Shah was not a significant person. Wiley, on the other hand, maintained very good relations with senior advisors to the Shah, and he entertained them and developed intimacy with them, and, of course, with other members of the diplomatic corps.
Can we call you the names of the Iranian officials at the...
Oh, the names elude me now. There was a doctor. No, I can't.
Okay. I have some questions about American policy towards Iran at this stage, around 49, 1950, at the time you've arrived in the country. How would you characterize, as you understood it, the Truman administration's overall approach to Iran at this stage?
Without any doubt, the attitude of the Americans at that time was that Persia was a part of the British responsibility in the world.
Mm-hmm. So they assumed that the British would more or less stand guard over various Western interests, oil, resources, and so forth?
Yeah, they not only felt that the British would protect Western interests, but in my opinion, they felt that it was not part of our responsibility to buck the British in Iran.
Some of the documents I've seen suggest that in some way the policymakers of the time, the State Department especially, saw Iran as sort of a buffer between the Soviet Union and the oil fields of the Arabian Peninsula. Was that a commonly held view?
Yeah, in strategic terms. Seems to me that the phrase always was, going back to Peter the Great, who I think wrote a letter or wrote a memorandum or did something in which he made it clear that he was anxious to reach the warm waters on the southern shore of Iran. I think that was more cliche than a very serious bit of policy thinking, but essentially the Americans viewed Iran as a strategic factor in the world rather than, in my opinion, rather than a source of oil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when you settled in Tehran in 1949, where did you live? What kind of living quarters did you have?
The first house we had was a two-room mud structure right across from the American Embassy compound. We moved into it because the man I had replaced expected to return, and we simply were filling his house in for that period. Then we moved to a house, a larger house, near the Russian embassy downtown, where, on a memorable moment, if I can just pause, my son was 1 month old, and my mother-in-law was there, and my wife was there, suffering from violent malaria, which she'd gotten in a blood transfusion. And we celebrated my son's first month birthday and built up a large fire, and the house burned down. And that was the last time we lived in that house. We then moved in to the home of a fellow Foreign Service officer, Walter and Margaret Howe, and stayed with them for 2 months. And to my great delight, I have just recently married Margaret Howe. Then we bought a house, we rented a place up in Gulhak, up high on the flank of the mountain, lovely garden and very comfortable house, and that's where we remained the rest of our tour.
What was Tehran like in those days?
When I arrived in Tehran in the mid-49, camels were still moving through the streets, the entire city. While I was there, the city closed off access to camels and kept them in the lower section. The taxis were about equally motorized or horse-drawn droshkis. The water system was the famous Jub system, which remained in effect while I was there. The great flank, northern flank of the city rising up the mountain was essentially open ground with these sort of summer villages at Gulhak. And then the southern part of the city was a swarming slum.
Did you do much traveling around the country during your 3 years in Iran?
Yes, I did. I went to Mashhad, went up to the Caspian, went to Tabriz, and then I flew to Ormuz, and drove a truck back from Ormuz all across the desert up through Yazd and to Tehran, and of course frequently visited Shiraz and Istanbul and Isfahan.
What were your impressions of the conditions in the countryside outside of Tehran during that period?
Well, I'd been familiar with Western China and the Central Asian look of that part of the world. And so, psychologically, I was quite prepared for the misery and unclean conditions. The Persian villager struck me as somehow more passionate. It's the only word I can think of. Intelligence isn't quite the word. Than the Western Chinese. The trucks and buses moved through the communities, so they were not as cut off from the world as the Chinese of Central Asia, in my opinion. Radios were, of course, in constant use all through the villages. It was a country that had not moved much from medieval times.
Okay. Now, during this period, what was the extent of the non-official U.S. community in Tehran, or maybe Iran generally? For example, were there many American businessmen there, or educators, clergy?
The American community non-official American community was dominated, in my recollection, by the Presbyterians, who were educators and medical people, and had a couple of missionaries who were extremely courageous men who would literally go into these small villages and preach Christ to these Muslims. Astonishingly, while I was there, none were attacked or killed. They were much revered. I'm not talking about the missionaries. The teachers were much revered, much appreciated, and there were very few businessmen. There was a well digger named Hannibal, who claimed to be a descendant of Pushkin. He was an American. There were a few American women who had married Persians here in the United States, and then returned, gone with their husbands back to Iran. But it was not a very large community. And when we gave 4th July parties, there would be a few Americans who would have come and who I believe were deserters from World War II. There was a black man, I remember, and we were all very careful never to pursue them and to welcome them, indeed. But it was not a large community. The British was the dominant Western community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you said during this period, 49 and early 50, you were a consular officer at the embassy?
My first job there was to run the consular section. There was a vice consul and myself and an American secretary, and we were very active, visitors' visas for Iranians, and then a large number of Russian Dukhobor types, strict Baptists and so on, who had fled Russia, and some Poles left over from the Polish encampments there during the war, who were seeking immigration visas.
And you worked at the embassy proper, or was there a separate section for the consular?
We had one of the large rooms, the old ballroom in the German embassy, and seems to me access was straight off the street, past the receptionist. The political and economic sections were on the second floor, and the administrative section was also on the ground floor, as I remember.
Was there much social interaction between the various officers, the consular section on the one hand and the political section or the economic section?
Oh, yeah, only about five or six officers,
yeah.
And we all were close friends. We were all professional Foreign Service officers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, it was a very close relationship.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when did you become a political officer as such? In 1950, mm-hmm. You became a political officer?
Seems to me in 1950. I was about a year in the consular section and then moved to the political section, which when John Wiley left, Henry Grady came in, and he was a much more organized man in bureaucratic terms, certainly. And the embassy took a more formal shape as sections developed. Before, as I said, Wiley and Durer ran a sort of a political section, but there wasn't any real sense of a section. Mm-hmm. Under Grady, it took the shape, and I was the junior officer in that section, and Roy Melbourne was my chief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, during the period you were in Iran, were you introduced to the Shah? Did you see the Shah at close range at any stage?
The Shah and I are very much the same age. He's about 2 years older. He and I were in school in Switzerland at the same time. Not at the same school, but we had that common experience. My French is very good. He was at that time close to Miss Côte d'Azur, who was visiting, let's say, the palace. My friends, by preference, at all posts have been French. I'm not speaking of the Americans. And so the Shah, and I was married to a very beautiful woman, And so we were frequently invited to the very informal parties where we played blind man's buff and musical chairs, and where the Shah and his sisters and Miss Côte d'Azur and others all joined in. And so my relationship, my personal relationship with the Shah was a very friendly one. And as I say, we were of the same age and we both had an appreciation of beautiful women.
What impression did you pick up of him? How would you characterize the Shah as you saw him?
Well, at this moment I want to put in this record that I wrote, while I was in Tehran, I wrote a dispatch on the Shah, which was classified, secret I suppose, maybe more. I have no idea if it's been declassified or published or anything, but it was a long dispatch describing in great detail aspects of the Shah's character and attitudes and his family. And it was a dispatch which was much read. I also might mention at this time I wrote a long dispatch on Mossadegh at that time called The Rise of an Iranian Nationalist, which also has been much quoted and referred to. Oh. Now, and I recommend both of those to anyone interested in that period. My own feeling about the Shah was then, and still is, although I was not involved with Iranian affairs in his latter years there, but my feeling is he was a gentle person, a person of very good intentions, a person much influenced by the Christian European experience that he had as a boy, and of course a person much influenced by his dominant father, both for good and for ill. His attitude toward the West was, I think, very sincerely favorable. After all, his father had set the pattern. His father was a great admirer of Ataturk, and the father had set the pattern of trying to work Iran toward modernization. He didn't get anywhere nearly as far as Ataturk did, but he was working in that direction. And the Shah, I think, always felt that he was carrying forward some of his father's banners. He was a decent man. His interest in women sometimes got in the way. His twin sister certainly had an undue influence on him sometimes.
Ashraf.
Uh-huh. But his own personal instincts were decent and conformed very closely to general attitudes that a young man born and raised in the West had. This is my general appreciation of his attitudes. As I say, my dispatch, which is a rather lengthy one, goes into a great deal more detail, but comes out with that conclusion.
You suggested earlier that Ambassador Wiley did not have a serious attitude towards the Shah, or not taken very seriously. Did Grady's attitude change? Did Grady have a different attitude, rather, towards the Shah?
Grady, again, I'm a little faint on the on the timing of these things.
Uh-huh.
But Grady reluctantly was forced to concentrate on Mossadegh.
Uh-huh.
And his attitude toward the Shah, I'm afraid, was that the Shah was a secondary factor at that time, that Mossadegh was the person to deal with and to influence if he could. I don't think he scorned the Shah, but I just think he had to concentrate on what he thought was the main objective.
Now, after 1953, when the Shah's position was restored, Mossadegh was overthrown, there was a developing view in the U.S., I guess the State Department and elsewhere, that the Shah was like a linchpin of stability in Iran. His position had to be supported as such to keep Iran politically stable and socially stable. Mm-hmm. What extent was that view entertained or held in the embassy or elsewhere before, in this early period, during the very early 1950s?
Well, when I was in the political section mm-hmm. in the embassy in Tehran mm-hmm. and wrote this dispatch on the Shah, which of course had to be cleared up through my masters,
mm-hmm.
It came down with a very solid conclusion that the Shah was worth supporting, and I certainly didn't use terms like linchpin, but mm-hmm. that but that he was the best of the known hopes for the future. When I was on the desk in Washington, I was there under Acheson and then on into the Eisenhower administration. And at that time, of course, the decision was made that Mossadegh should be overthrown and the Shah should be brought to a firmer status of power. And I think, rather like what happened in Vietnam, once you have a hand in overthrowing somebody, the way we killed, or Kennedy killed Diem, once you have that, then you become much more committed to the person who comes in. I don't remember, while I was in Washington, I don't remember policies being built upon the feeling that the Shah was a linchpin. I think more it was a sense that, well, he was the best there was, and he was a legitimate ruler, and that he was a popular ruler, which I think he was when I was dealing with those things.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, when you were political officer, when you became political officer in 1950, the course of 50, what were your responsibilities? Did you have a specific assignment?
When I went into the political section, there, at that time, in the embassy, none of the officers spoke Farsi, nor did I. Jerry Dewar had spoken sufficient Farsi to get along, but certainly was no linguist, and he was gone by this time. Perhaps in the CIA units there were some serious Farsi speakers, that's possible, but they were not being used publicly for the ambassador. About the time I came to the political section, Mossadegh was becoming increasingly a figure. And Grady, in order to negotiate with him, Grady could not speak Farsi, of course, and Mossadegh did not speak English, but Mossadegh refused to have an Iranian in the room, and the embassy had traditionally used a very fine, very honest and reliable man named Saleh, who spoke excellent English and was an Iranian, was the senior Iranian in our embassy. Mm-hmm. Mossadegh refused to allow him to participate in any of these intimate conversations. Because he distrusted any Iranian. And therefore, they turned to me. I spoke French. And Mossadegh had been educated in Neuchâtel back in the late 1800s. And his French was not bad, although he used college expressions, which would be sort of like 23 Skidoo and cat's pajamas, which would pass right by me. But basically, for a period of time, Grady and Mossadegh had personal conversations with me acting as interpreter in French. It was not the best way to deal with very high policies, but it was the way we did it.
Mm-hmm. So that was one of your responsibilities. And then, of course, you monitored the internal political scene as well.
And then I was, that's right.
Did you develop contacts? Like routinely with local political figures in the country, in Tehran?
Of course, some. But I'm much too modest to say that I was had a broad range of contacts in the Iranian political community. I was still a fairly young man, mm-hmm. and the Iranians place a great stress on age, and I did not speak Farsi. I don't remember that I covered the Majlis. Maybe I did, but I don't think so. I think mainly I was engaged in, as I say, this concentration, this constant concentration on Mossadegh, and writing up the memoranda, the telegrams, reporting these conversations, preparing for them. And I did, as I say, some traveling around the country and did some reporting there. I can't remember anything else.
Okay. How would you characterize the political climate in Tehran during the first year or two that you were in the country?
Well, again, the rise of Mossadegh was the dominant feature. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew Ras Marah a little bit, and my wife was in the bazaar the day that he was killed, and mm-hmm. when she came home that day, she told me that she had been in this great teeming bazaar with a friend, and all of a sudden, everything became very quiet, and that they became alarmed, these two women, and they left and came home, and Ras Marah was killed shortly after that. And Mary always felt that the bazaar was well aware that Ras Marah was going to be assassinated. And indeed, I've had Persians say to me, not that time, that Ras Marah himself had a sense of martyrdom and that he thought he was going to be killed that day. This is all Persian. Uh-huh. And then, as history shows, there were a series of efforts by the Shah to avoid having Mossadegh come to power. As I remember, Allah became prime minister for a while, or mm-hmm. things like
Hussein
that.
I
can't remember the details, but in any case, Mossadegh came to power, and this great surge of nationalism, anti-British nationalism. And that's what dominated the period that I was in Iran. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, while you were a consular officer in October 49, middle-class politicians organized a national front, I guess initially to protest the lack of free elections. That's what I've read recently. Mm-hmm. And then they went on to the oil issue as they progressed politically. What was the embassy's attitude towards the national front in the early 50s, late 40s?
I really don't. You've got me on that one.
Yeah, okay.
I think I was punching visas. That's basic.
Yeah, right. Okay. Now, this, again, you might not have been close to this question, but you mentioned General Ras Marah a few minutes ago. I've read recently that some embassy officials, especially Gerald Dewar, believed that the Shah needed to be backed up by a strong military figure like the general. Were Dewar's views very influential?
Dewar's views were very influential on John Wiley. The two of them were like, in my opinion, were like boys at games.
I thought you mentioned that earlier.
And, for instance, they invented a fictitious major somebody or other, who was an American agent riding with the tribes in the mountains and so on, and they leaked this news, and it even got in the American newspapers. These were joyous people. I think Wiley was taken in by Dewar, whom I don't think was a very serious person. But Dewar had influence on Wiley, and Wiley therefore had influence on Iran. But I really think that the Americans at that time were not being taken too seriously by the ruling class of Iran. I think Mossadegh took the Americans more seriously than his predecessors.
According to a new book on Iran by James Bill, Dewar played an important role in convincing Wiley to urge the Shah to appoint Ras Marah as prime minister in 1950. Do you know much about Dewar's role in this episode?
Well, I would say that's right. I think Wiley and Dewar thought it was a good thing for Ras Marah to come to power. But I don't have any more details.
Yeah. Okay. Now, of course, one of Ras Marah's biggest opponents is Mossadegh, apparently, who was a key figure of the National Front. Now, you said you met Mossadegh as translator between conversations with Ambassador Grady. What were your impressions of Mossadegh?
I was very fond of him, and he was fond of me. It was almost like a grandfather-grandson relationship. And I don't think he ever felt that he could influence American policy or even Grady through me. Nonetheless, I felt always that we had a nice personal relationship, and that and he was always pleased to see me, and we would have a little bit of genial chat when we worked together. And one time he accepted an invitation to lunch at the residence. This was a great concession on his part. And it was Gray's effort to have him talk directly with the British ambassador. And I remember Mossadegh said he would come only if I were present and would handle the translation, which really shook the British ambassador, because there we were sitting, I would translate Mossadegh's French, which of course the British ambassador understood perfectly well, into English. And the British ambassador would then have to speak in French, and Mossadegh would sort of wait for me to speak. It was terribly amusing. Anyhow, it was part of his constant effort to distress the English.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Any more comments you want to make about Mossadegh as a person?
Well, for one thing, he was an older man. I mean, mm-hmm. My God, he... Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody ever knew exactly how old he was, but he was a very older man, and he was a very, very successful speaker and whipper up of emotion. I don't think he had the slightest intention of coming to terms with the English.
Another question.
And I think he had a great abiding belief that America would eagerly replace the British, and therefore replace the British on his terms. And I think he was truly stunned that the Americans and the British hung together. In addition, I think that Mossadegh was a man who really did not have a constructive program. He had a program of driving out the British, but I don't think he had a very clear idea of what would come next.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much contact did embassy political officers have with the national front politicians besides Mossadegh? For example, the later foreign minister was Hussein Fatami. Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet him? Did other people deal with him?
Fatami was a rather slick boy of a young man with a man with very good family connections out of the Qajar aristocracy, which of course had an abiding hatred for the Shah. And we all knew him. Kashani was Mullah Kashani was a different quality. I think Jerry Dewar played games with Kashani a certain amount. I don't remember ever meeting Kashani. My guess is the CIA had some better knowledge of Kashani and his entourage than I did. I don't remember the names of the others, but Saleh's brother was very close to Mossadegh. Saleh was the senior foreign national in our embassy, and had two brothers, a doctor and then a nationalist.
You suggested that the CIA might have had contacts with Ayatollah Kashani. Did the embassy have any contacts with other clergymen?
As I remember, we had nothing but a sense that the mullahs represented the past, and that the Shah and that the future and the whole trend of events would move away from them. Indeed, despite the fact that there was a great deal of American interest, you know, Justice Douglas came out and rode the mountains with the tribes, and Jerry Dewar was interested in the tribes. And so, nonetheless, I remember John Wiley once saying that these centrifugal forces, are those the ones that fly outward?
Yes.
That the centrifugal forces, such as the tribes, were doomed, that everything was going to move toward the center, and Wiley, as he often was was wise in a very sophisticated sense. At the same time, he loved playing patsy with these tribal leaders whose father had been killed by the Shah's father and who had an abiding hatred, again, of the Shah.
We can make fun of the summer before,